Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the speech today by Secretary of State John Kerry that denounced the right-wing settler movement in Israel for putting the two-state solution in serious jeopardy, and speak with Avraham Berg, who was Speaker of the Knesset and a leader in the Israeli Labour Party and the One Israel Party. He joins us to discuss the fury on the Israeli right against Obama, who they blame for orchestrating the UN vote against Israel over its continued expansion of Jewish settlements in the disputed Palestinian territory, and his disappointment in both Obama and Kerry for taking this stand in the last days of their administration when they should have stood up for a peace deal on their first day instead of wasting 8 years. Then we'll look into the irony that the Israeli right sees Donald Trump as their hero riding to the rescue, as he has promised in his tweets, while the neo-Nazi white nationalists of the alt-right here in America hail Trump's victory and see Trump's right-hand man, Stephen Bannon, as a leader of the alt-rights, since Bannon himself has called his publication Breitbart News the platform of the alt-right. Brian Levin, the director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University San Bernardino, joins us to discuss a heavily armed anti-Semitic protest march against Jews and Jewish businesses by American Nazis planned to coincide with Trump's inauguration. The march will be held in Whitefish, Montana, where the leader of the alt-right, Richard Spencer, is a part-time resident. Then finally, with Donald Trump's cabinet shaping up to be a team of billionaires, we will speak with the author of Oligarchy, Jeffrey Winters, a professor of political science at Northwestern University. He joins us to explore why the angry white working class voted for Donald Trump, who ran as a populist. And since it is clear now, and will be even more so once Trump is in office, that giving more power and wealth to billionaires will not benefit working Americans, will there be an even angrier electorate 4 years from now? And joining us now is Avraham Berg, who is the son of Holocaust survivors, who has been active in Israeli politics as the leader in the Israel Labor Party and the One Israel Party. He was Speaker of the Knesset from 1999 to 2003, and is the author of The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes, and is the chairman of Malad, the Center for Renewal of Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Avraham Berg.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And what is the reaction in Israel to John Kerry's very impassioned speech at the State Department, a kind of final salvo, if you will, at Netanyahu and perhaps Naftali Bennett and the Israeli right? There's obviously a lot of frustration on both sides, but he did express a certain amount of frustration on the American side.
Listen, people did not yet have a real chance to react because it happened, an hour ago, it ended. Prime Minister did not yet react, but I can tell you immediately the following things. A, it was brilliant, eloquent, accurate, and irrelevant. I mean, coming a week and a half or 2 weeks before his term expires makes it as a beautiful theoretical narrative. But where have you been, Mr. Kerry? Mr. Secretary, where have you been in the last couple of years? So it's irrelevant. The second is it falls on the over the ground of the Israeli right, as Secretary Kerry described himself, as the most right-wing government Israel ever had. And therefore, whatever he says just intensifies their feeling of the entire world is against us and they don't understand us. So who are they, these people, and see what they did to the Middle East, etc., etc., etc. So by the end of the day, he will be just some kindles or will be some food for the fire of the right-wing rhetorics, but no real impact.
Well, but in Israel, do people understand that when you have a 14-0 vote in the United Nations,
irrelevant?
You don't think they get the notion that the world is it's one thing for the world to be against them, and it's another thing for Israel to be out of step with the world.
Many Israelis, unfortunately, too many Israelis. Do not see it the way I would say your question sees it, or the way I see it. People are not really concerned personally about the international isolation of Israel, etc., because they live under the doctrine or they live under the paradigm that anyway the entire world is against us. So, well, I mean, okay, so they're against us. What can we do? But on the other hand, we're living in a prosperous, economically quite secured relatively to the rest of the Middle East. Personally, I feel very good here, says the average Israeli to him or herself. So therefore, well, maybe it's not nice. Maybe the music is not really harmonious to my ears, but it's fine. I mean, it's fine. I mean, it's much difficult now in Damascus, much more difficult in Gaza, even in Ukraine. I mean, they have more problems than we have. So, okay, we don't like it, but it's okay. We can survive it. That's the general attitude.
Well, if the Israelis are to say, well, you Americans have screwed up the Middle East, they would be absolutely accurate. Not that I think you can't blame Obama, but you can certainly blame Bush and Cheney, Rumsfeld and Rice.
Sure.
And one of the ironies that I see of how the chips have fallen since the ill-fated Iraq misadventure is that essentially the very thing that the Saudis have always been worried about, the so-called Shia Crescent, is becoming a reality where Iran will be able to project its power through its proxies across Iraq, Syria, and into Lebanon and right on Israel's border. So, the Likudniks were the ones that supported Bush and Cheney's misadventure in Iraq, were they not?
You know, I don't know how the American average memory works, but the Israeli one is quite a short term. George W. Bush, remind me, who was he? People don't remember.
Right.
Invasion to Iraq, you know how much water was... we had under so many bridges here in the region ever since. Mm-hmm. People do not remember. People do not blame. People for sure see that as for now, as you said, the Obama's administration seriously screwed up the Middle East. They do not see the largest, I mean, most of the people do not see the largest context. And therefore, they will say, listen, as unpleasant as the situation is, we are still an island of stability. So if works, why fix it? What do you understand, you, the world? I mean, what did you do better than we did? Immigrants, Middle East, conflicts, Iran. People don't see it as if either the EU or NATO or the American administration of the last couple of years really understand what's going on in the region, and therefore we don't trust them. I mean, most of the Israelis do not trust them, and therefore do not listen to them, unfortunately. I mean, I don't say it's my personal position, but I try to reflect to you and to our audience what's the general feeling in Israel.
Well, but Aaron Berg, if it appears to be the case that the Europeans, who are very supportive of Israel initially, particularly the French, for example, if all the Europeans are voting against Israel's treatment of the Palestinians, it seems in a peculiar situation where Israel is losing old friends and the new friends that they're gaining are Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, hardly trustworthy friends.
Ian, you interviewed the wrong person. I fully agree with you. Unfortunately, I'm a tiny minority in my society. And unfortunately, the majority of the Americans do not see eye to eye with you because they elected I would say an isolationist as the President of the United States of America. And most of the Brits voted for the Brexit and breaking away from the European traditional policy vis-a-vis the Middle East. So some majorities in some societies think differently the way I think. What can I do?
Well, again, I'm speaking with Avram Berg, who's a son of Holocaust survivors and has been active in Israeli politics as the leader of the Israeli Labor Party and the One Israel Party. He was Speaker of the Knesset from 1999 to 2003 and is the author of The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes, and the chairman of Malad at the Center for Renewal of Democracy. So there is a context, though, to Donald Trump's election, and that is, he was helped in part by a lot of billionaires, the Mercer family, who are very, very big supporters of the Israeli right. the settler movement. He's got his son-in-law who's also very close to that. Sheldon Adelson is a big player in Republican politics here as a financier, but he's also, I understand, an even bigger player in Israel. So it seems like the billionaire cabinet that we have here in the United States with the incoming Trump administration has its sort of mirror in Israel, does it?
That's too big. I mean, we do not have in Israel the money nobility running the place, though the triangle of money, administration, and media is a very dominant triangle here in Israel. And in that sense, Israel is now is not different than some of the societies around the world, like Italy of Berlusconi, Turkey of Erdogan, America of Trump, and a few other places. Yes, there is a phenomenon like this. Do I believe it is desirable structure? The answer is no. Do I believe it will last for long? The answer is again no. People are angry, so they vote for whomever is the anger container. But I do not really believe that Trumpism has a chance to become a solid power in world politics long term. I don't think it has any sustainability. It's a whim, it's a political whim, but I do not see it as a political solid force.
In terms of what John Kerry, back to his speech today at the State Department, where he basically made a last-minute plea for the two-state solution, let's talk about the one-state solution, which is a nightmare for many. I mean, there's two different versions of it. There's the Palestinian version and the Israeli right-wing version of it. Which one is likely to happen? I mean, at the end of the day, what people are concerned about, particularly on the political left, and again, you know, you say it's powerless, in pretty powerless in Israel, and it's certainly gotten whipped here with Hillary Clinton's pretty pathetic campaign that she ran here, although there is a resurgent left with Bernie Sanders. We'll see where that goes. But in general, I've never understood what the end game of the Israeli right is. So let's start with that. What kind of a one state does Naftali Bennett and others want? What's it going to look like?
I have no clue. You have to call him. I have no clue. I think it's a flight to nowhere, but who am I? I mean, I think that he goes nowhere, but he got a lot of support for this nowhereness. So I really cannot tell you. I mean, I do not stand for them. I do not vote for them. I do not understand them. I think they're causing a lot of damage, but I have no clue where it goes.
But do they, for example, is it a sort of delusional idea that somehow the Palestinians will go away, that, you know, the worse you treat them?
Ian, you ask me to do something that I refuse to do. I'm not their spokesperson.
Right.
I'm their opposition.
Right. I understand that. But
I do not want to represent their case here.
Right. Well, but do they have a case? I mean, this is what's so extraordinary.
You'll
is
have to ask them and judge right. it yourself.
Right. Well, but we know we have a peace process, but we don't have peace.
We don't have any.
Yeah. Well, but that's what I'm wondering.
We don't have neither peace, no process, no peace process.
Right.
It's just illusion and empty words. America wasted 8 years in the region.
What would be the explanation for that if you don't want to speak on behalf of the Israeli right?
Softies, no concept, no understanding, no process, nothing. No
uh-huh.
concept.
Right.
Imagine the John Kerry philosophy of today would have been the politics of the last 4 or 8 years. And Obama, like when he wanted Obamacare, he put all of his weight behind it. Would have put all of his weight behind it.
Well,
he gave a speech and went away, and then came and then gave another speech and visited and disappeared and nobody knows and changed his mind and climbed trees and climbed down trees. Who knows?
Right.
Was such an inconsistent politics here in the region that he lost the respect of both the Palestinians and the Israelis and the Americans.
And do you think that that what happened with Clinton was a warning to them? And they did the fact that he at the last minute he put a big effort in and it almost got there and failed. Is that are they simply gun shy or are they is there too much? My sense is that
I can't tell you.
Uh-huh.
I cannot tell you because I find it very difficult to decipher or to comprehend the American foreign policy, not just here. I don't understand it in the Sea of China. I don't understand it in trade. I don't understand it vis-a-vis Russia. I don't understand it in so many other places. So we are just a tiny fragment of it. I have no clue. Do you know what was the American foreign policy in the last 4 years or 8 years?
No.
So what do you want from me? I'm a little man from a little place. I mean, you had a Secretary of State who traveled to hundreds of places, and with this credit of traveling all around the world, failed to win elections.
Well, but
because she had no position.
Right, but surely, Avram Berg, you have to admit that you may be from a little country, but this is a little country that gets an awful lot of attention here in the United States.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Oh, yeah, but, you know, but by the end of the day, look what Jimmy Carter in one term did.
Right.
Forced Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat to make peace.
Right.
And see what Bill Clinton almost did.
Right.
What Bill Clinton didn't help to do in the Good Friday in North Ireland,
right?
And see
right.
what he did here during Oslo till whatever happened, and see what this president did not do here.
Well,
Obama, that I admire him, and I think he was a great American president, and I hope this is how history will remember him, was a lousy Middle Eastern leader.
Right. Well, what's happened with both Obama and Kerry at the last minute, it does seem a little kind of petulant in the face of what you're suggesting, which is true, that they really have failed, they didn't really seem to try. As a journalist, I've learned very easily over the years that when you talk to government officials when they're in government, you learn absolutely nothing. But when they come out of government, you actually learn something. So is this the syndrome here, that only at the very end are they going to speak the truth?
I wish I could give them that. I mean, you know, uh-huh. You give them so much credit for me, it's just pathetic.
Right.
As simple as that.
Right. Well, then...
Middle East is not a place that a very charismatic, eloquent speech can solve problems.
Well, I think, though, that in many ways the chips have fallen since the ill-fated invasion of Iraq. There's a new strategic architecture happening there, as we've loosely talked about, with the Shia Crescent and this strange alliance that Israel has with Saudi Arabia and Egypt. What do you think Trump is going to bring to the table?
Listen. There is no doubt that the folly invasion of George W. Bush to Iraq caused two things. It did not introduce democracy to the region, because there is no top-down democracy in any place around the world, and it put an end to a century-old Middle Eastern order. George W. Bush destroyed the Middle East. The failure of Obama, as intelligent and as intellectual and as brilliant as he is, that he failed to understand the new Middle East and to propose it a new philosophy, a new paradigm. So he functioned in the year 2008 to 2016 as if we are still in the early 90s. So this is stupid. As for Trump, I have no clue. I mean, if you will tell me what Trump will do about the Obamacare, I will give you my prediction about Trump in the Middle East. But you are no smarter about immediate moves that were part of his campaign promise.
Right.
So what do you want about something that was not part of the campaign promise? I have no clue. Who knows about him?
Well, I think he's
the good Lord in heaven sits there and scratches his or her head and saying,
right.
I cannot even predict what this guy is going to do. There is no prophet born to prophesy the lunacy or the surprises of this individual. Who knows?
Well, the one thing that we can predict, and at least it's based upon his choice of ambassador, which is his tax attorney.
Oh, brilliant.
I mean,
his strategy is so chief of staff. What fantastic choosings. America is going to have a good time, I promise you. Thank God I live in Israel.
Well, you know what the Canadians are saying now is we're going to build a wall, and you Americans are going to pay for it.
Fantastic.
Listen, great. It's good to talk to you, Avram. I'm sorry
Thank
it's
you
not.
Very
it's,
much, dear.
We'll talk again.
Bye, Ian.
Bye, bye. And again, I've been speaking with Avram Berg, who's the son of Holocaust survivors and has been active in Israeli politics as leader in the Israel Labor Party and the One Israel Party. He was Speaker of the Knesset from 1999 to 2003, and he's the author of The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes, and is the chairman of Malad, the Center for Renewal of Democracy. We can take a brief station break. We're back talking about a heavily armed anti-Semitic protest march against Jews and Jewish businesses by American Nazis planned to coincide with Trump's inauguration. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director for the study of hate and extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in analysis of hate crimes, terrorism, and legal issues. And previously, Professor Levin served as associate director of legal affairs at the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama. And he was also a New York City police officer in the Harlem and Washington Heights sections of Manhattan during the crack wars of the 1980s. And he recently testified before Congress's Homeland Security Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Levin.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian. And if I may, just Happy New Year.
Oh, thanks.
It's always a pleasure being on your show.
Well, thank you, Brian. And as we approach the inauguration of Donald Trump, apparently in a small town in Montana, Whitefish, Montana, a group of neo-Nazis are planning a march where they've been carrying arms because it's very permissive firearms laws in the state of Montana. And the purpose of this march apparently is to protest in this town of, I think, about 6,000 people. These neo-Nazis are going to be marching in protest against Jews, Jewish businesses, and everyone that supports either. And I just find it pretty extraordinary that this is the town where Richard Spencer, the leader of the sort of alt-right movement, Stephen Bannon, who's the chief strategist for Donald Trump, claims that the Breitbart is their platform of the alt-right, and yet you've got this strange sort of anti-Semitism being revived by these alt-right people who feel that they somehow Donald Trump has given them permission to come out of the woodwork. I mean, what's the purpose of this, as far as you can tell, coinciding with Trump's inauguration, and the town apparently is where Spencer's mother lives and he's a part-time resident. So can you figure out what these people are trying to do?
Yes, there was a local dispute, I guess, with respect to Spencer spending some time at his family's residence, and potentially, I guess, that reflecting on the town. Although he is admitted to spending some time there, as you know, is a free country, he can spend time with his parents. But it was giving Whitefish, Montana, a bit of a bad name. So a dispute came up, and there seems to be a misunderstanding. There's a group called Love Lives Here, just a local group, and there was potentially going to be a protest. And a local realtor then got involved and said, like, you know, look, you know, if you want to put out a statement, Mom, in other words, Spencer's mom, saying that you disavow your son's politics, a rally or a protest against Spencer wouldn't be held. And then something got thrown into the mix that Mrs. Spencer felt that she was being harassed and she was being pressured to sell the place, and a local realtor was going to assist her. In the way it came out, it sounded like perhaps Mrs. Spencer was being pressured. Then the Daily Stormer asked for a troll storm against various people in Whitefish, including a child, by the way, putting his picture up, among others.
And the Daily Stormer, by the way, is a popular American neo-Nazi website, right, that features Richard Spencer quite a bit. And he's the leader of, as far as one can tell, of the white nationalist movement here in the United States.
Well, Spencer, interestingly enough, and this is perhaps a longer history than your listeners may want. Spencer took over the National Policy Institute and really coined the term alt-right some years ago. The National Policy Institute was previously headed by a fellow named Sam Francis, who was a bigot, who also supported Holocaust denial and all this other stuff. So these weren't pristine characters, if you will. Long story forward, both Spencer, who basically held a Trump celebration in D.C. where people were giving Nazi salutes, and that was covered in The Atlantic, has also been going to some colleges. So what's interesting is he is really riding a wave of publicity. He spoke at Texas A&M earlier in the month, and there were protests. He was invited by an alum, not the administration. So he has been part of this kind of media wave. The Daily Stormer, along with Spencer, have been fervent supporters of President-elect Trump. And Bannon's Breitbart is a widely followed news website for both conservatives, but also for the alt-right. So that's where this all comes in. We don't even know whether or not this march in January is going to take place. What they said is, there are open carry laws in Montana, and armed Nazis from all over the country can come and march. I don't even know if that's going to happen. Every major political character in Montana has decried this Nazi march, and I believe one of them is and double check me. I think one of the congressmen is up for appointment in the Trump administration. They've all condemned this march, which may not even take place. We'll see. Sometimes it looks like it might be called off, but that's the state of where we're at now, and this has become a national rallying cry for neo-Nazis. How many will actually show up? If it does take place in January, we don't know, but I can tell you there will be a significant presence of law enforcement if that occurs.
Well, we were just talking to former Speaker of the Knesset in Israel in the earlier in the program, and there's a lot of fury in Israel against Barack Obama, and John Kerry made a speech today critical of the Netanyahu government and the possible abandonment of the two-state solution, Kerry expressed his concern that the time was running out for a two-state solution there, and a lot of the Israeli right are angry at Obama and they say that he's anti-Semitic, and that they're all counting on Donald Trump, and so. It's so strange that Donald Trump would have this fellow Bannon who's attracting this alt-right group, and you'd have people like this Spencer character having a speech in Washington, D.C. recently where he made the Nazi salute and yelled, "Hail Trump, hail our people, hail victory." Now, nobody's accusing Donald Trump of being anti-Semitic, but it's an odd kind of paradox here that this is actually a real anti-Semitic march that these guys are planning, right? This is not there apparently, I don't know, as far as I know, there's not an awful lot of Jewish businessmen in Whitefish, Montana, but apparently whoever they are, it's that's the lightning rod for these characters, right? I mean, it's the whole thing is I'm trying to sort of navigate through this, is what's going on here, why do these characters somehow see this new Trump administration as emboldening them and bringing them out of the shadows?
Well, for one, I think that with respect to President-elect Trump, one of the things that really appealed, actually there were two things that really appealed to them, was on the one hand, Euro-nationalism, white nationalism, the notion that, as per Mr. Trump's statements about Mexicans, also he made other statements too, talking about the Hart-Celler's 1965 Civil Rights Act, which is roundly criticized. Even if you go to neo-Nazi rallies, there will be people at these rallies who are neo-Nazis who will be able to speak about that particular legislation, which most of us aren't looking at on a daily basis. But what it did is that was a piece of legislation that took away the white bias and the European bias with regard to immigration. And immigration since that time, over the last 50 years, has become much more diverse, where countries in Latin America, Asia, and Africa are among them, and South Asia, the most represented. So they speak about that. Donald Trump has spoken about that, saying that he wants to change immigration back to traditional patterns prior to that act. So that's something that was very important. So this notion of white nationalism, Euro nationalism, which is the way that the new hard right, which does include racists in there, views immigration. So there's that. There's also the fact that Trump really went against the firewalls in the Republican Party that would prevent overt bigotry from being displayed in a sustained manner. So if you look at various Republican leaders before, Mitt Romney, John McCain, George Bush the Elder, who signed the Hate Crime Statistics Act, there might be disagreements on policies, and people might disagree with what their positions are, but I don't think people would say, you know, these folks are out-and-out hardened racists. Of course not. And they condemned it. As you know, just read John McCain's concession speech, for instance, or his confrontation with a supporter who described President Obama as a, quote, Arab. He dismantled that. So one of the things that the alt-right loves about President-elect Trump, and I'm not saying that he is a bigot, but what they liked about him is the alt-right wanted to dismantle the traditional Republican Party because of that firewall that prevented them from getting into the tent. Once that firewall was dismantled, a lot of people, including people who were not bigots, felt that they could come into this freewheeling tent that existed. Coupled with this Euro-nationalism. And what's interesting is that nationalism is something that we're seeing throughout Western Europe and in the right wing of Israel as well. So there's an interesting division and dichotomy about nationalism and white nationalism, which has some shared components both in the United States and overseas. So that's why these folks like President-elect Trump. And what's so interesting is I have not seen this in my professional adult career of the kind of support for a mainstream candidate, let alone an elected official, by these white supremacists with such unanimity. We have not seen this arguably since the run in 68. I believe it was George Wallace. George Wallace, where I believe he carried five states.
Right, right. And so just in the last couple of minutes then, You can understand my confusion here, right? That on the one hand, that white supremacists are bringing out feeling that Trump has emboldened them and given them permission, and on the other hand, he's being hailed as a hero in Israel, and Obama is being accused of being anti-Semitic because of the positions he's taken. So I find that deeply ironic, given that this march in Whitefish, Montana is essentially, it's pure unadulterated anti-Semitism, isn't it? The Daily Stormer says that's what they're marching to protest. I mean,
absolutely, and both Spencer and Andrew Anglin, who runs the Daily Stormer, are out and out anti-Semites. What's very interesting, though, because I can hear in your question, what allows this to happen a bit, though, is even within the alt-right, while definitionally it's pretty much anti-Semitic, there are segments of the alt-right who say, no, whites are okay. Even whites that include Jews, Ashkenazi Jews, so they're okay, and then there are others who say, no, they're not. So there's an interesting, ragged edge to this, which can include, white nationalists, some of whom say, no, Jews should be included in this. We're picking fights with the wrong enemies. And there's a debate within that. There's a debate within the alt-right about who should be included. So Milo Yiannopoulos, a gay firebrand who goes on college campuses, had the Daily Stormer declare war on him. So there's this interesting division that takes place within the alt-right as, I don't want to say matures, but as it moves forward with the mainstream acceptance of who's allowed and who isn't. And this is just one of those interesting things that gets thrown into the mix. The notion that President Obama is an anti-Semite is something that plays well within the very hardened parts of right-wing Jewish supporters of Israel, but does not play well within the mainstream Jewish American population, who have supported him more than any other social group other than African Americans. Support right. Between 75% and 82% for Obama.
Well, just in closing, obviously, we've got to have some proportionality here. There's only, 200 of these clowns are going to show up with their guns at the best, even if the march takes place.
So it's maybe not, less.
Yeah, so it's not a big phenomenon. The only thing that's strange is that the guy that's right at the right hand of Donald Trump is associated with these people, and that's Stephen Bannon. That's where it gets weird to my mind.
The core of this is white supremacists. But within there, there's also this libertarian freewheeling debate variable of the alt-right, which allows debate on whether or not gays should be in the alt-right and Jews. And just concentrate on keeping Latinos and Muslims and blacks out, that kind of thing. So it's a freewheeling, very interesting, but also scary circumstance that exists as the alt-right is politically mainstreamed.
Well, Brian Levin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, as always.
And again, I've been speaking with Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in the analysis of hate crime, terrorism, and legal issues. And previously, Professor Levin served as associate director of legal affairs at the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama. And he recently testified before Congress's Homeland Security Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. We can take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into why the angry white working class voted for Donald Trump, who ran as a populist. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jeffrey Winters, a professor of political science at Northwestern University, where he specializes on oligarchs and elites, spanning a range of historical and contemporary cases, including ancient Athens and Rome, medieval Europe, the United States, as well as Indonesia, Singapore, and the Philippines. He also studies state-capital relations, capital mobility, and the structural power of investors, the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, and the World Bank. And he is the author of Oligarchy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeffrey Winters.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And it does seem, in a way, that oligarchy is a global trend. There was an alarming study from Oxfam that found that 85 families control half of the world's wealth. So since you've studied particularly, say, medieval Europe, it does feel like a sort of new medievalism, if you will, a global version of it, where you have a small minority of a global elite, and then you have a very small technocratic class of lawyers and accountants and doctors and professionals, and then you just have this massive underclass. Is that a dynamic that's detectable?
Yeah, and in fact, if we put this in some historical context, there's a very strange thing that has been happening over roughly the last 200 years. On the one hand, democracy has been increasing. That is, if we look at the total number of countries that are democratic, as well as looking at how democracy has spread within countries. You know, initially, only a limited number of people had access to the vote, and then eventually they struggled and had universal suffrage. On the one hand, the trend line of people's participation has increased. And yet, and this is the bizarre part, concentration of wealth has also increased dramatically over the same roughly two centuries or two and a half centuries. And one of the things that this poses is sort of, why doesn't democracy help? How can it be that we're becoming, in some sense, more distributing power in a formal way, that is one person, one vote, and yet we aren't getting policies that are spreading the product and spreading the wealth more? And one of the reasons that's happening is precisely what you were talking about, which is alongside democracy, which is just a political arrangement, who gets to vote, who gets to participate, freedom of expression, and so on, is another kind of power, and that's wealth power. And that is very unevenly distributed to start with and has gotten even more unevenly distributed because those who have wealth power use it to influence the political system to advantage themselves. And it turns out that in the battle, as it were, between democratic power and wealth power, wealth power is winning.
Well, in terms of wealth power, there's nothing more stark, I think, than this irony that the president-elect Donald Trump, who ran on a populist platform and has appointed a billionaire cabinet. I mean, it's not just billionaires, it's multimillionaires as well. So it's an extraordinary phenomenon. I just wonder whether we have reached a point in our politics where we have a kind of political equivalent of the Stockholm syndrome, where we effectively identify with our torturer, the idea that the wealthy elite in this country have been the beneficiaries of the fact that they own our politics and been able to change the tax law so that they don't pay taxes and they get immensely rich and the country's infrastructure and polity and social fabric frays and starts to crumble. And we're on that trajectory. Yeah. And yet, rather than bring about a change, more equity, after all, you know, income inequality was an issue in this campaign, but the outcomes are the reverse of reform. It's reaction and digging the hole deeper.
I mean, if you think about the choices that the American people had this time, the choices were essentially between either career politicians such as Hillary Clinton, who we know are bought and paid for by oligarchs, by Wall Street, and so on. And although Hillary Clinton tried to play down her performances before Goldman Sachs for very, very large fees, and we know from the Podesta emails that, you know, Hillary Clinton understood that she needed to say that she wasn't really heavily woven into the ultra wealthy, and yet it turns out she was. So on the one hand, you had that choice. On the other hand, we had an oligarch himself, a multi-billionaire, who basically battled initially with the Republican National Committee and the party. And so, you know, Trump himself has told us that he spent an entire career doing pay for play. That is, he admitted before his audiences that donors give money because they want something in return. And so the Republican Party is bought and paid for. We had the choice of an oligarch who was also running and somewhat against the Republican Party. And then we had Hillary Clinton, who's also bought and paid for because the DNC is responding to the same kind of power. The only choice among all these folks who was not bought and paid for by very big interests and oligarchs was Bernie Sanders. And it was interesting that he made a run for it and got an enormous amount of support. But those were essentially the choices. So I expect that this is going to play out in a way that is going to disappoint the people who voted for Donald Trump.
And again, I'm speaking with Jeffrey Winters, a professor of political science at Northwestern University, where he specializes on oligarchs and elites spanning a range of historic and contemporary cases, including ancient Athens and Rome, medieval Europe, the United States, as well as Indonesia, Singapore, and the Philippines. He also studies state-capital relations, capital mobility, and the structural power of investors, the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, and the World Bank. And he's the author of Oligarchy. So, could it be then, Jeffrey Winters, that if you have a choice between Hillary Clinton, who got paid in, $250,000 to give a little pep talk to the employees of Goldman Sachs, which became a major campaign issue, which Donald Trump beat her up on incessantly, mm-hmm. and then he turns around and has a Treasury secretary who's literally, born and bred at Goldman Sachs. His father was a major executive there, and he became an executive there. And then you've got two or three other Goldman Sachs people in other cabinet and sub-cabinet positions as well. So is the calculus here on the part of the angry voter, well, if we're going to have somebody that's sucking up to the rich, Why don't we get the authentic product itself, the rich person?
Yeah, it's here's as far as I can discern it. Here's the strange logic going on in the minds of the core Trump voter. First of all, they're angry at the establishment. They're angry at the government, which appears to them to serve only special interests and wealthy people at the top. And there's this process where the donor class pays an enormous amount of money during campaigns and then reaps the benefits afterward in terms of policies. And so supposedly the average voter detests that system, right? And so the fact that Hillary Clinton had 30 years of experience being in the government was the worst possible thing as far as they're concerned, because you're in the government. So then the question is, well, okay, let's pick an outsider. Well, who are the outsiders who are available? Well, it turns out that only basically an oligarch was able to put himself forward. First of all, it takes a lot of money to be able to run a successful primary campaign and then a successful presidential campaign. So an oligarch comes forward, and the logic supposedly is, well, this person's already super wealthy, therefore this person can't be bought, and the hope is that this billionaire is somehow going to care about the status of the average American and implement all kinds of policies that are beneficial to them. But here's what the reality is since Donald Trump has been elected. First of all, if we look at the parade of people who have had access to him since his election, roughly a third of the people who have gone up the elevator at Trump Tower have been people who spent at least $800,000 each as donations for the Trump machine and for the Republican Party. Now, how much is that? That is over 25 times the median income of the average American. So, that's just a donation they made. So there's been this parade of people who have had access to him precisely because they're wealthy and because they've made donations. The whole argument was that those folks weren't going to be the ones who were going to have access, that it was going to be change. The real reality is that it's business as usual.
Well, if you look at Trump's career, it's not very hard to see him as a successful salesman who has essentially sold the very product, success, his success. And whether it's real or not, whether he's as rich as he says he is sort of immaterial. The whole point is he projects this image that I'm incredibly successful. And he marketed that, as we know, with Trump University, where he basically got a bunch of people to buy into the idea that some of his success would somehow rub off on you, like the gold dust that would sort of sprinkle off his body as he walked through the golden marble of Trump Tower. And these people gave money that they couldn't afford to him in order to get a piece of his magic. And what happened? He got richer and they got poorer. That's the reality.
Yeah, that is the reality. And if you look at the lineup of people in the cabinet, the story is basically the same. We're looking at a cabinet. When all is said and done, the net worth of this cabinet is going to be somewhere between, and depending on whether, you know, Trump is as rich as he says, we will never know until we see the tax returns. But, you know, when you add it all up, Trump plus all his billionaire and centimillionaire cabinet members, we're looking at somewhere between $20 and $25 billion. This is a staggering amount. There's never been a richer cabinet, and not one of these people has a history of, you know, being one of the few oligarchs in America who actually try to do something for, you know, the average person. The vast majority of them have employed the wealth defense industry people you were talking about earlier, the lawyers, the accountants, the wealth management professionals who have done all they can to preserve the wealth of the people at the top, to cut taxes on them. And that's something Trump has promised to do. He's bringing in a labor secretary who thinks that the minimum wage is too high, doesn't even like the idea of a minimum wage. So how low can it go? Well, whatever the market will bear. Why anybody out there thinks that that's a good idea for the average American, I don't know. And your point on the Trump University is very interesting, because statistics have shown, and research has shown, that one of the most transformative things we can do is public education. Public education actually makes a difference in people's life chances. It skills them up. It makes them viable for jobs. And he has appointed a secretary of education who hates the Department of Education and public education. So he's lining up people who are sort of the opposite of every department that they're supposed to head. And this is sort of like just hating the establishment, hating the state. I can see why a lot of Americans don't like a state that doesn't serve them. But that doesn't mean that a bunch of oligarchs who are going to come in and just tear it apart is going to be beneficial to the average person. In fact, quite the opposite. And I guess we're going to have to wait 2 to 4 to 8 years to actually see how this plays out. But we may have an even more angry electorate 4 to 8 years from now than we had this round.
Well, in terms of what Trump has said about the billionaires in his cabinet, because, you know, first of all, this is an extraordinary situation, how this guy got elected with $5 billion worth of free media, and yet he insults and demonizes the press, and in fact incites his mob against the press, threatens to change the libel laws, yet they give him all this free media, and he doesn't even give anything back. They never got to find out his tax returns, and he doesn't even want to have press conferences, and presumably the media will, particularly the television cable people who thrive on all of this bread and circuses that he throws their way, that they'll probably go along with it. So there won't be any watchdog on him. There won't be any his feet won't be held to the fire, and he won't be held accountable because he won't even have press conferences. So we don't know what he really thinks about anything. But at a recent rally in Des Moines, Iowa, in response to this issue of having so many billionaires, Trump said, and one newspaper criticized me, why can't they have people of modest means? Because I want people that made a fortune, because now they're negotiating with you, okay? What does that mean? Can you decipher that?
Well, I guess, let me just make a comment that you about what you said a moment ago about the media, which is that I'm sorry to say that we have very little actual information-based press left. What we have is a vast entertainment industry. And if people want to be entertained, so be it. If they don't want to be informed, so be it. We do live in the remnants of a democracy, and so people are going to have to live with what they choose. By the way, the media always says, well, no one wants information, so all they want to tune into is entertainment, and so the two sides blame each other. I don't get quality information. All I get is entertainment. So around and around it goes. I don't know what the answer to that is. On the point of you know, Donald Trump's statement in Des Moines, it seems to be that he equates getting ultra rich with some kind of special talent or ability, and he also seems to think that that can be translated into being an effective decision maker, an effective person in government. Well, we don't have much experience with oligarchs and centimillionaires in government. But one thing is for sure, government, especially democratic government, is very different from the corporate world. Let's recall that the corporate world is actually a bunch of authoritarian institutions. They're not democratic. You have a CEO and a board at the top, that is the dictator and the oligarchy, and everyone else down below takes orders. And if you don't want to take orders, you have two choices. You can either be fired and go to another authoritarian top-down institution, or you can quit and go to another authoritarian top-down institution. So these are people who are accustomed to authoritarian structures that don't have a lot of information and demand coming up from below. So, you know, is the idea that having these very authoritarian kinds of figures who are not accustomed to listening to constituencies and the people out there, is the idea that that's going to make them terrific managers? I don't know. Most people find that when they get to Washington, you have an enormous standing bureaucracy. They control the information. They control the flow of information. And these folks are able to change very little. I guess that's one of the hopes, isn't it, that they're not going to be able to tear everything apart and that they're going to run up against a lot of resistance.
Right, but they're going to try. I thank you for joining
they're
us.
They're going to try.
I thank you for joining us, Jeffrey Winters.
It's my pleasure, Ian. Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Jeffrey Winters, who's a professor of political science at Northwestern University, where he specializes in oligarchs and elites spanning a range of historical and contemporary cases, including ancient Athens and Rome, medieval Europe and the United States, as well as Indonesia, Singapore, and the Philippines. He also studies state-capital relations, capital mobility, and the structural power of investors, and the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, and the World Bank, and he's the author of Oligarchy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Jose Benavides. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.